welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast by Zentano for forward-thinking leaders who want to lead with confidence, clarity, and impact. We bring you grounded wisdom, real stories from real leaders, and conversations that leave you thinking differently, feeling inspired, and ready to act. Let's dive in. So welcome back to the Connected Leadership Podcast by Zentano. My name's Dave Morris, and today is a Voices of Leadership episode with my guest Matt Robinson. More about Matt in a second. Now, today's episode tackles one of the most talked about, least understood, and hardest to measure topics in leadership, workplace culture. In an era of AI, skill shortages, and constant change, has culture become the hardest business advantage to get right? McKinsey's 2026 global research of over 10,000 executives found that leaders are shifting their focus away from short-term resilience towards building long-term productivity through AI, but also organizational culture remains one of the biggest determinants of whether any transformation will succeed. So that begs the question, has culture moved from being an HR issue to becoming one of the few remaining competitive advantages? Microsoft's latest work trend research found that 80% of employees say they lack sufficient time or energy to do their work effectively. Slightly worrying. Meanwhile, over half of leaders believe productivity still needs to increase. So that creates a fascinating tension. Many organizations are trying to solve overload with AI, but AI doesn't fix poor leadership, low trust, silo behavior, lack of clarity, or a fear of speaking up. Those remain culture problems. And many organizations will say their culture is great. They'll point to engagement surveys and awards and benefit packages as proof. But what if much of that data isn't actually telling the truth? My guest today is Matt Robinson from CultureNav. Matt has spent his entire career working across brand, employee experience, and employer value propositions, and has become increasingly focused on one big question. What is really going on inside organizations, and what is hiding beneath the surface? In this conversation, we'll explore his journey, how his thinking on culture has evolved, how leaders can move beyond assumptions to fully understand what it is like to work inside their organizations, and with that data into hand, how they can make better decisions. So Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I think it's going to be quite a big discussion today. My plan probably is to do this over two sessions, so we'll explore your journey and your thoughts on culture, and then maybe in part two next week we'll dive into the work that CultureNav does in terms of how we measure culture. Fascinating topic for me.
Absolutely is, yeah. Absolutely, I'm very deep. Very deep topic too.
I'm very deep. So let's start with your beginnings. If you could sort of answer the first question, which is, what has shaped Matt's life? You know, go down to the early days. What was your influences, and where did leadership really sort of show up first for you in life?
Good question. Great question, in fact. So, a bit of background: I'm born and raised in the Northwest in Cheshire. A bit of a sporting background in my younger days. During those younger days, really, that's where I suppose I learned lessons in culture without knowing at the time what they were. Or how that it was in fact culture. So I spent a lot of time playing rugby as a younger person, and in that playing rugby, understood the context of, I guess, culture again without being able to put the label of culture on that thing. So that was more about when you're playing the game, understanding what's happening, the dynamics of what's happening when it's happening, rather than it being leadership kind of point someone in the direction and say, hey, you go over there and do this, and you come here and do this. More understanding the fact that actually what's happening here in the dynamics is about pulling people together and understanding how people work together. So at an early age, probably 15, 16, 17, is where I sort of started to learn that stuff.
Okay. I mean, sport is usually for a lot of us where we start to, as you said, we don't realize we're learning about culture, but we are, aren't we? And it's quite, and did you say when I first spoke to you that you had a vice captain role? So you had a degree of influence over this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously the captain's the captain, has the armband, and everybody kind of looks to the captain. But really, the captain's the talent in our team. The captain was the talisman, whereas I was kind of more the heart and soul of the team. So I would be there to motivate people. I was there to get people up and going and pull people together. So where the captain was making the decisions, I was kind of doing the work behind the scenes, so to speak, to pull people together. And it was more a role of, I guess, whilst there was a label to it, vice captain, it was kind of an unofficial, it was official, but it was kind of an unofficial sort of way of working, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of people, though, in businesses have influence without formal authority. I mean, some people have the formal authority in terms of their position, but others don't, do they? But they can still be very, very influential, which has a massive impact on workplace culture. So there's definitely a parallel there, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was interesting in the parallel, looking at that parallel really, was in that team or in teams that I have played in, it's kind of the bigger characters would carry more influence. And that's the same, really, in what I've experienced working in culture. You know, if culture isn't intentionally kind of designed and built, the biggest voices, the biggest characters, the people with the most charisma tend to kind of dominate that stuff. And so looking at that parallel, as a vice captain in rugby, it's your job to acknowledge those characters, but perhaps manage them in ways where they don't get to dominate others, because others have different skills and different ways of working. So the parallel does exist, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we first spoke, you said that your journey wasn't just team-based. You also experienced individual performance too. So can we sort of dive into that? What did you learn from all aspects of competitive sport that you got involved in, and particularly what you learned about performance and mindset as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I was a prop forward. So, you're kind of playing that role that it kind of goes along with it, that you have to get in the gym. Yeah. You know, you can't do that without a bit of heft and a bit of strength. So alongside the rugby, lots of weight training, circuit training, but weight training mainly. And that at an early age switched something on for me.
Okay.
I guess the resistance piece, it's you against the weight, it's you versus gravity, essentially. And so whilst the parallel with playing with rugby, I started to do Olympic style weightlifting. So, you know, a clean and jerk snatch. Was naturally quite strong, quite fortunately, and entered into a competition and won a competition. So I was a junior national weightlifting champion at an early age.
Wow!
And what was interesting with that was the mindset switch from team to individual. So where the team kind of mindset is you're pulling people in and you're looking at the dynamics and the context in the moment, the fight with the weightlifting is just with yourself. And you're sure, you're fighting gravity, but actually you're fighting yourself. Can you get that weight? You add a little bit? Yeah, exactly that. Can you add that little bit more? Where's the performance? Where can you adjust? And all that kind of stuff. And it's a bit of a mind, weightlifting's a bit of a mind game.
Did you, I mean, at that point, I mean, I've never performed elite sport, but I guess it's to a certain extent, it doesn't matter what level you play at, but when, you know, the more elite, the more tougher the competition, did you have to manage a lot of self-doubt and performance pressure that was actually not put on you by anybody else, but it was created by you, effectively?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And in the moment, it could be crippling. You know, say you just, I don't know, let's say you just managed to get a personal best. Fabulous. But then the push to drive something beyond personal best is always there, because your best is never good enough in that scenario. Okay. But also when you kind of reach the limits, or you're getting towards the limits, your mindset, you start to play games with yourself. You know, the voice kicks in of, well, can you? That's a little bit more than you struggled with the last one. Can you do this? Are you capable? Are you able? What's your capacity to get this thing in the air? All that kind of stuff. And managing that self-doubt is a very difficult process, you know? And again, parallels. I've seen that in myself and others through my career in business. You know, self-doubt, people are racked with self-doubt. Mask it very well, but when it comes to performance time, that self-doubt will always out.
I mean it's interesting, we'll get onto workplace culture later on, but I think if you have a workplace culture which is solely driven by performance, these are the sorts of issues that are going to come up. And you know, Rich and I have done a whole series recently on confidence in leadership, and I think this is where confidence starts to ebb away, isn't it? Where, as you said, those doubts come into your mind, you start asking yourself those questions like, am I good enough? What happens if I fail? What's going to happen to me? All of those types of questions start to ping up in your mind, and they just eat away at your confidence.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And confidence is a great word, isn't it? Because people, you know, people are confident. And actually, confidence and performance, I guess, are, for me, I guess, if you're confident in your performance, then you will perform. You don't have to think about confidence because you're performing. But there's a lot of preamble in terms of, I'm confident I'm going to get this done. But then the confidence ebbs away when actually the challenge occurs. And so there's that whole piece of kind of like, masking confidence. A lot of people do it. And again, it goes back to what I was talking about, people with charisma, big characters. There's a lot of confidence in there. But is it justified? Is it real? Can they perform when the time comes? And it's that really that I've seen kind of in myself and others sort of in my career.
You've obviously seen a lot of different businesses, both in terms of the businesses that you've worked for and now the businesses that you go in on a consultant level.
Yeah.
How often do you see real, grounded, you know, sustainable confidence inside cultures?
Not as often as you'd think.
No.
And what's interesting with that is you will see, I have seen, at a leadership level, and depending on the organization, again, confidence can be a mask.
Yes, leaders absolutely.
Leaders aren't always confident. They will, you know, they'll project confidence. They have to. That's part of their job. But at the same time, they're racked with self-doubt. And so around a board table, decisions are made. And it's all about, yes, we'll do this. Yes, this is definite. However, being a good leader requires actual grounded confidence. And I've not seen it very often. There's probably a handful of times.
It's interesting. I mean, Rich and I have spoken about this on the podcast recently quite a lot. We've just launched our own online program about confidence and leadership. And the point we make in that program is that confidence is a skill that you can learn. The more you try to fake it till you make it or perform it or pretend, you know, that will get found out, particularly when the pressure ramps up, which, you know, in a lot of business at the moment, the pressure is ramping up for all sorts of reasons. I think it's a really, really interesting issue, and it has a direct impact on workplace culture, clearly.
Oh, hugely.
Yeah.
If you have leaders who are grounded and confident, the rhetoric is usually, it's not hyperbolic, so it will be genuine. You know, communication will be genuine. People will believe in leaders. They will thought there's more purpose behind people below the leaders. Managers understand things better, things are clearer, things get done quicker. Where leaders are performatively confident, that doesn't really follow. The actions won't follow what's said.
No. So you started off, you know, in sport, that taught you a lot of things about culture that you didn't know it was lessons in culture at the time, but looking back you realize it was. It talked to you about confidence and mindset management as being a big part of you know, how you perform well. And then I guess you went into the world of work, so just talk about your early career. How did that shape how you think about communication and influence, which is what culture is all about basically, isn't it?
Absolutely is. So my early career, By training and by education, I am a graphic designer, I suppose is what you call me. So I went to university, got a degree in visual communication, came straight out as back in a long time ago, 1990. when was that? 1998, entered the workforce as a multimedia designer, which at the time was a really cool job to have. You know, web designers, yeah. Multimedia designers. So I spent a couple of years kind of working, not really aware of culture, just kind of nose in a Mac, designing stuff, making stuff. And kind of a couple of years into that, you kind of bring your head up from the minutia of the internal focus of the work, because the work itself gets easier as you become more confident with it.
Yeah.
And you kind of bring your head up and then you start to realize people around you a little bit. You start to understand the dynamics of that business and how people operate. And I'm not saying within a couple of years, but that comes quite quick. But with the, I suppose, ability that as your ability increases with what you're actually doing, you are able to step back a little bit more because you have more capacity to kind of be in the environment. And so the early career was a lot of that, multimedia, web, a little bit of animation. And I did that for about three or four years, kind of came through that and started to get interested in brand development.
Okay.
For the fact that, you know, multimedia was what it was and everything else, but actually that's the one of the delivery mechanisms for a larger thing, and that larger thing was brand. And I got really interested in developing brands. What's the purpose behind brands? Why is somebody building a website for this brand? What's its purpose? What does it do? Why does it do it? So I started to ask questions, and then kind of by way of career, became a bit of a brand specialist. Read a lot about it, learned a lot about it, started to move my career more towards it, moved out of the digital space and more into the strategic kind of brand development space. And that's really where I started to see I suppose, the cultural stuff. Again, aware of the word culture at that point, but not really able to kind of link it into what I was experiencing, what I saw others experiencing.
But I'm guessing when you're doing, I mean, I've not done brand development as a job, but because I came through a professional sales background. But one of the things I had to have in professional sales, and I think this would apply to your work in brand as well, is you have to start to understand the psychology of influencing other people's behavior. Did you sort of do some study on that, or is it just something you sort of started to realize as you picked up experience on the job?
On the job realization and experience, really, it's the whole piece of, I guess it's growth. You could call it growth. You start small with a career. You're doing something. You move a bit further. You take a bit of a pivot, and with that pivot comes a new challenge. And there's new challenges where I started to kind of see the psychology side of things. Where,
okay.
Yeah, you can design a brand. You can spend millions designing brands.
Yeah.
But if the psychology behind that brand and the purpose isn't right, then all those millions of pounds are to waste for the fact that it's not going to land with the intended audience. So that's where it kind of started to click for me in terms of, what's this brand promising? What are they getting?
Okay, interesting. And you used a very interesting word there, purpose. Because I know when we first talked, you said at this stage of your career, there was a sort of realization in your head that actually output without having purpose behind it just kind of feels empty to me. There needs to be more to it than just creating output.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's this, as a graphic designer, and if any graphic designers, listen to the podcast, they'll get this. We'll be handed a piece of work in their career and we'll be told, oh, can you make that look pretty?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where you will receive a huge amount of information, whether it's data or it's a document or it's something really complex, dumped on your desk. Oh, just make that pretty. Make it look really good. It's like, well, there's a lot more to it than just making something look really good.
Yeah.
And so it's the purpose behind what you're doing, what you're creating, really, and the promise it gives and how it delivers that promise is what's important there. And so if you kind of fast forward that there to the brands, when you're developing something that doesn't have purpose, where it looks fantastic, it could look amazing, but there's no purpose behind it, there's no real connection, emotional connection behind it, it will not land well. It absolutely won't. And that came as I started to move from, I guess, brand, pure brand, into employer brand.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing you realized that you wanted more than just delivering work, that you wanted more to it than that. And so you went moving into more employee benefits, that type of work, was it?
Yeah, that's right. And so that came by way of obviously working at an agency, creative director of an agency. We had a lot of work from one particular client. There was a particular type of work that was different to other types of work. Mm-hmm. That work was broadly employee benefits at the time. This is quite a time ago. So it was employee benefits brochures, employee benefits websites, little tactical communication pieces. And that was quite interesting. I thought, well, hang on, the messaging here is different. The audience is different. It's a captive audience you're working with because they work for an business, and you're communicating to that particular audience. Well, this is interesting. So I kind of got into that and obviously started designing these things, seeing how they were delivered, and then actually seeing the results on the far side of it, where money had been spent, time had been spent on producing something of quality that went into an employer that had absolutely zero effect.
Oh, what? Why was that then?
Well, it's for the fact that at the time, employee benefits were kind of, but still are in many ways, a tick list item for kind of HR leaders, in that, oh, come and work for us, you'll get X days off a year, you'll get this many sick days you have, you can do, there's a bike scheme, there's this, that, come on, we're a brilliant employer.
Yeah.
Well, employee benefits aren't culture. They're the nice to have sprinklings on the top of a culture cake, if so to speak.
Yeah.
And these employee benefits brochures and all these media that were going on to these customers at the time, they looked great, but they were broadly ignored. And it's kind of like, well, why were they ignored? And that's where the spark ignited for me in terms of what isn't landing? The design is
right.
Great. The quality is great. The content is great. Why isn't this landing? And that's where, I guess that's where the fascination started with culture for me.
Yeah, I think you said when we first spoke that, because I remember when employee benefits were really taking off and, you know, everyone was trying to do it and do it well. But I think you said what you started to realize was that it was being used by many employers as a superficial fix for actually issues that were much, much deeper in their businesses. Issues around retention, engagement, which sounds very familiar to today's world, to be fair. So just talk about that. How did you get that early exposure to employee engagement and retention challenges through your work?
So that was when I moved from that into pure employer branding, which is where we're developing kind of careers websites and you're running careers content for these businesses. And the messaging in that is very much, our culture's brilliant, come work for us.
Mm-hmm.
And in that is where that disconnect happened, right? In terms of, this looks great. This is what this business is saying it is. Yet on the other side of it, people are leaving and people aren't happy. And the people I talk to in that marketing department doing that work with us aren't happy. Why aren't they happy? Hang on a minute. You say you're a brilliant place to work, but these people say different. Where's the gap? What's going on there? And so that's really, I suppose, where I started to see where you're putting effort into these things, into those cultural things, is where the gap is. And in that gap, people were throwing employee benefits. Oh, you know, we're a great place to work. Brilliant. I'll join you. Things aren't as expected. I'm off. Oh, no, don't leave. Here's a benefit. Here's a perk. Here's another benefit. Here's another perk. So they were being used as a kind of salve in many ways. It's a quick fix. Throw a load of benefit to somebody. They'll stay for a month, two, maybe 3 months. But those things are quick. As soon as they run out and employee benefits become invisible really quickly, people will leave if the culture's not right. It's much better to have a genuinely, objectively good culture without benefits than it is to have one that's really not great with benefits.
Mm. So I'm guessing at this point you started to notice a lot more about organizational culture. And as you said, the gap between what organizations say and what employees are actually experiencing in reality. So talk to me a little bit about that, because I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. So that employer branding piece really opened my eyes, and that's where this came from. So all those career sites, all those social content, all the stuff driving recruitment for those businesses were projecting a certain image.
Yeah.
And that image is attracting as many, and the general thinking then was, well, attract as many people as you can to recruit. The bigger the pool, the easier it is to recruit.
Yeah.
There was a disconnect even there in terms of, well, you don't need the biggest pool, you need the most appropriate pool. So these things were like casting a very wide net and then sifting through. And that's why, you know, that's why recruitment cost a lot of money. That's why attrition was extremely high. They were recruiting the wrong people. The recruitment process wasn't designed to get the right people in. And so that was the first disconnect. But that second disconnect goes back to kind of what I just said about the fact that people would join a business based on the promises of that, their own research and the promises of what that business said about themselves. Oh, we're a great culture. Come work for us. They go through the recruitment process, become an employee, and they find out the reality is very, very different from what was promised. And this has happened. I mean, this has happened so many times, particularly in my recent work, where I'm talking to people about their experience. And the number of times people have kind of sat down and go, well, I joined for these reasons. It looked great. I did my own research and spoke to people. They said it was great. And I joined in this department. And it's terrible. I'm going to leave. It's kind of like, well, where's the disconnection? Because they spoke to somebody perhaps in a different department, or they believed the hype and the hype didn't exist. And that's where the culture disconnect absolutely comes from. It's the external messaging promising something that an internal reality can't deliver.
And what are some of those things that the internal reality is getting wrong then?
So you will see on most career sites, you'll see that, oh, we're a great place to work. We've got a great culture. Brilliant career development plans. Join us. You know, you'll have a great career. You join, there are zero career development plans.
Right.
And this is one of the biggest things we've seen. Like, people will join a business and they'll go, wow, great, brilliant. I'm here. I'm going to go. What's my plan here? How do I advance this company? Oh, well, work here for a bit. You become a manager and it's like, well, that's not a development plan. Where's the training plan? Where's the personal development? Where's the actual plan? You know, there is none. So that's one of the biggest ones, is kind of the personal development stuff.
Yeah, I think that's become more important in recent years. As I remember when we started work, I mean, I started work quite a long time ago, and I think we didn't ask those questions when we were being recruited. We were almost quite glad to get a job and start work, and we expected that if we worked hard for a little while, we might start to climb the ladder a little bit. But I don't think that's the reality in the modern workplace. People come in at a younger level now, and they expect you to better tell them, well, how are you going to develop me? That is it's a key question they want answered, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a very valid question. You know, you think about how much time we spend at work, and particularly as a younger person entering a workplace. You know, you've got a lot of energy. You want that career. You want to do the very best for yourself. But if that business doesn't equip you with a forward plan for yourself, you're just going to kind of, it becomes a job, not a career, or it goes back to purpose, doesn't it? Really,
it does. So that's one issue. So they were promised development. It wasn't there. What other sort of things are you seeing?
So what are people promising that they aren't delivering? Do you know the biggest one? And it's kind of exactly what we're talking about, is culture itself.
Oh, go on. Yeah.
So the number of times you see we have a good culture or join for the great culture, people will get on the far side of that, become an employee, and the culture is absolutely not as it's stated. It's different because organizations are kind of articulating culture as this holistic thing. Our culture is great. The reality is that culture actually exists at personal and at team level. And everybody's different. Teams are different. So two teams have completely different subcultures and microcultures, which interact in a different way and cause experiences.
Yes.
And organizations aren't looking at that. So people will join a team thinking, this is going to be great for me. And actually they get there and they find out that they're working in silos. They find out that, you know, they've got an accidental manager. They find out that their teammates don't talk to it. Communication's a huge problem and all of these things. And that's the biggest thing that we see, is that culture is being used as this huge box of things. Here you go, you get this, rather than the purposeful lived reality of what's inside that business. That's the biggest thing we see.
So it sounds like from your experience, and I think I would agree with this in my own experience, is that culture, it sort of develops very organically. It's often unmanaged. It's not managed intentionally. And I think you said to me, well, you can't polish a bad culture, can you? That's a good insight. You can't, can you?
You can't. I think you use a different word than culture. But yeah, yes. Yeah, exactly. You can't. You can't. But people do. Most organizations do. If you go on Glassdoor's a great one. It's a great one. It's where people go to have a good moan, right? But if you go and have a look on Glassdoor and you find a business that promotes itself as having a fantastic culture, if there are enough reviews, kind of middling to lowish reviews, that tells you everything you need to know about what's going on underneath. Yet there's still a level of polish. And it's a waste of time, resource, and money for that business. So they're paying somebody to actually design and build a website, design and manage an applicant tracking system, all these things, recruitment processes, people that work at HR, resource. Brilliant. We're going to track that. And then it's not that, it just doesn't land. It's a waste of time and money. So polishing that culture, it's probably better if you go out warts and all. You kind of say, well, we're okay. We're working on it, rather than, oh, we're brilliant.
Yeah.
It's a case of the most businesses I've seen and we work with overpromise and underdeliver on culture.
Interesting. So I guess that begs the next part of our conversation, which is what leaders get wrong about culture. And I think we should probably challenge some of the most common assumptions. So what do you think leaders typically get wrong when they assess culture? I think that's a good question to start next.
They think it's an HR initiative for a start.
Right.
So culture, that's HR. That doesn't have a place at the board, in the boardroom. It's HR, let HR deal with it. And because HR are always seen as a kind of a cost center, it never gets funded. It just sat there, and it's kind of like HR will run out of engagement surveys just to be able to prove to leaders that, oh, the culture is good, bad, or indifferent. That's the first thing. They don't take it seriously. It's seen as soft and fuzzy.
Yeah.
I guess the second thing we see is a huge red flag, massive red flag, is when leaders and HR say, oh, we're like a family.
It's
one of the biggest things that we see. It's like, oh, we're like a family. It's like, really? So you fight at Christmas?
Really? I was going to say, a lot of families are dysfunctional. So is that?
Yeah, exactly. And you don't get to you don't get to choose your family, but you do get to choose with who you work with. And so that familial kind of over like a family, it's an absolute red flag, because it's essentially a mask that allows ropey behavior, sketchy behavior. Oh, we're like a family. Well, if you're behaving like a family, people will fight, people will argue, people will fall out, you know, all this kind of stuff. Yet that we're like a family badge is almost used as a kind of like, I think what they're trying to say is we're a perfect family. We're the picture perfect family. It's absolutely not the case. Something else they get wrong, as we kind of touched on, was benefits. Throw benefits at something.
Right. Okay.
If it's not working, throw benefits at it. They don't stick. They absolutely don't stick. I think, I can't remember the statistic, but EAP, which is employee assistance programs. So people who have personal challenges, if you have an EAP program, you can pick up the phone, you can talk to somebody about something, you can get help, you can get personal help with stuff. They are not used at all, for the fact that in the majority of cases, employees have to go through a line manager or an HR director to get to that EAP, to get to that assistance. And the assistance itself isn't always adequate for purpose. And but it's used as a badge. Oh yeah, well-being's great here because we've got an EAP program. There's nothing wrong with EAP programs in and of themselves.
No.
But it's when they're used as a badge of, oh, look, we look after our people, we have an EAP system in place. It's another one that kind of gets wrong. The biggest one, and it's a real bugbear of mine, is engagement surveys. Leaders will use engagement surveys to prove they have a good culture. The problem with this is the surveys are usually under-designed, so it'll be a bunch of numerical questions. And usually they're extremely long. They'll be like 30, 40 questions long. And they will ask random questions, but they are based essentially, the question sets are vanity metrics. So what comes back to that leadership is X percent of people agreed that this is a good place to work. Y percent of people said yes, they love working here, and those questions, they mask everything because they're surface level and they're vanity based. So that's one of the biggest things they get wrong, because we have a customer who had a particular score when we engaged with them, and it was exceptionally high. It was excellent.
Okay.
It was almost an unattainable score. I'm not going to say the customer nor the score, but
no.
An exceptionally high score, and the leadership team were over the moon. It's proof. We're brilliant. We went in and we did what we do.
Yeah.
The score halved because we actually went underneath their survey and talked to people. The score halved, which obviously people weren't happy with. But the fact is, that's the gap between what leaders are doing to measure culture and what culture actually is. So there's this huge disconnect at the moment. An understanding of culture itself too. Who actually can stand up hand on heart and say what workplace culture is?
I'm sure we can come up with a whole raft of definitions, Matt, about what it is. What would your definition, just out of interest, be? How would you define it?
I keep it as simple and as high level as possible. So essentially, how things get done around it. That's broadly it. Without getting into academic models, into research and all that, it's the simplest explanation I feel works best for culture. And interesting, when we talk to people in businesses, we ask them specifically about the culture, and we don't position what it is because we want to understand what's that person's understanding of the word culture in the context of work. And we had responses we've had. It's just clear, culture is not defined. So if people aren't defining culture, and managers aren't defining culture, and leaders aren't defining culture, well, what are they measuring?
Yeah. Well, two things leap out for me in listening to you explain all of that. One is, it seems to be a lack of real evidence behind some of these cultural claims that are made. I think you said that a lot of it is surface level evidence, which, you know, may or may not be reliable and accurate.
Yeah.
And the other thing, and probably more worrying, is that our leadership teams, and I mean particularly senior leadership teams, because obviously they set the tone for all of this, are they often avoiding very uncomfortable truths?
That's an excellent question. I obviously can't answer for all leadership teams.
No, of course not. But in your experience, I'm saying, in general terms, you know.
Yes. Absolutely. This, you know, this goes back to the point we talked about earlier about confidence. Grounded confidence. The leadership teams who are genuinely confident, grounded in a grounded way, are actually looking for the uncomfortable truths. Because the uncomfortable truths is where change happens. That's where change happens. But the percentage of those leaders who are confident and grounded and able to look at uncomfortable truths and not take it as a criticism, very few and far between. The majority of people I've seen in my experience will avoid that, hence the vanity metrics. Additional to that, kind of reporting those truths up always gets a little bit squiffy too, for the fact that somebody at board level make a decision about a particular project. It will be handed down to the managers. Managers will hand it down to the people who do the work. People will do the work. A deadline might be missed. Something might go off. It won't be delivered as intended. Yeah, it will be reported up as it is being delivered as intended, for the fact that nobody wants to put the hand up and go, well, there's a problem. And so managers will buffer the truth to leaders. And that's a problem in and of itself. Many leaders don't want to hear an uncomfortable truth about their business. It's difficult to hear, difficult to take. Most managers won't want to report one up.
No. But I mean, if we're going to have this grounded confidence in our businesses, that relies on humility. And by humility, I mean a very objective opinion of where we're strong, but where we've got gaps, where we've got points where we could be better, you know, and it's owning that, warts and all, isn't it? The good and the bad together. And I think we get too many people maybe that are a bit, for whatever reason, driven by ego in leadership, where, as you said, they don't want to hear that stuff. Now, not everybody, clearly, but that is quite common, whether we like it or not, whether people listen to agree with us or not. That is my experience. It's also your experience as well.
100%. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And it is interesting that, and I've noticed it is changing. It is changing over time. Leaders, I think, are becoming more open to it. So the fact an uncomfortable truth is a reality. Nobody's making that stuff up. It exists. And if you want to improve, you know, want to get an outcome for your organization, you need to tackle that uncomfortable truth. If you don't know about it, you can't tackle it. And so there is a bit of a change afoot. It's slow, but it has changed. You know, the last 4 or 5 years, I've certainly seen leadership teams being more open to listening without judgment.
That's got to be a good thing, isn't it? And I do wonder whether, you know, some of the world events that we've been putting up with in recent years, where it has created so much uncertainty and ambiguity and, topsy-turviness in our businesses, that maybe people are just thinking, look, we need to get under the skin of all this. And we don't have all the answers. Let's be honest about it. We don't have all the answers. Let's dig down a bit deeper and find out what's really going on.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly that. Exactly that. It's that willingness, I think. Willingness to look at what's actually happening, because most of the time it's not as ugly as people think.
No. So I guess the next question for me would be, if we go from the subjective to the objective and consider how we move from opinion into what's really going on in reality, how do you turn culture into something which is measurable and real in a business?
The golden question. It's difficult to do, because you have to overcome the barriers that are in place. So one, we have to overcome what's already there, the engagement surveys, the stuff that's been around for donkey's years that people believe is culture. You have to get underneath all that. And so the first hurdle is kind of positioning that as what it is, and then getting in there. So the first thing you have to ask leaders and businesses is, okay, you've got your engagement surveys, but where's the real evidence of culture? Where are you getting this evidence from? Because your engagement survey isn't it. So how can you objectively say your culture is good if you don't have the numbers behind it to be able to evidence that? And usually that's a kind of hands in pockets whistling moment for most leaders. They'll be like, well, actually, we don't have the data. Okay. So this is about getting down to in the weeds of people's experience in an organization. Talking to people, going and talking to everybody in an organization to understand their experience, because it's the cultural pillars that drive those experiences. And so it's by talking to people, we get to understand and see and hear the stories that have come from those pillars. And it's from that you can then, not generate the data, that is the data itself, the qualitative data piece. that you can feed back to leaders and say, here's the unfiltered truth. This is real. And the way we go about that, rather than gathering data, what we're looking for in that stuff is really, it's about behaviors and habits, repeating behaviors and habits.
Yeah.
It's not about grand statements. It's not about what people say. It's about what people do and how they feel because of it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it reminds me of that TV program that I used to watch, Undercover Boss, where you'd have somebody very senior, you know, almost get in disguise, go into the sort of the front end of their business and suddenly realize, oh my God, this is what it's really like inside my business.
It's exactly that. And do you know, one of the most interesting things I've found is values.
Okay. Yeah.
Organizational values. So, you know, you'll go to a leader. What are your values? Oh, it's this, that, and the other. Brilliant. Okay. Why do you have those values? Well, because we are those things. Brilliant. Go and ask people, what are your values? If you go all the way down to from the boardroom, all the way down to the newest hire and go, you know, okay, so this business has values. What are the values? Well, I can tell you they're A, B, and C. Great. What do they mean to you?
Yeah.
Well, they mean, and they'll trot out what they've been told in the HR PowerPoint deck.
Yeah.
But it's getting underneath that and going, okay, well, that's great. That's towing the party line. But what do they mean to you? How do the values in this business actually impact your behavior? How do they drive how you behave when you come here? Yeah. Are you even as an individual aligned to those values? Yeah. You join this business for a career. But the values might be in conflict with your own personal values. How do you reconcile that? So there's a whole piece around values and understanding experience and the behaviors, I guess, the impact behaviors and habits that values drive at every level of that organization is a fantastic base of evidence to feed back and say, well, your values are generating these conflicts and these alignments, and these are the gaps between them, and this is what you can do in the middle of them.
I think, as you know, you said about employee engagement surveys and the like, and you know, some of the benefits packages and what have you, being traditionally been an HR thing. Yeah,
yeah.
Values is another one that has been. That's what HR sort out. Yeah,
yeah.
That's not true. Inside a business, the senior leaders must not only embrace them, but they must understand how to behave along in line with them. And they must consistently hold each other to account to do that, because that's how it starts to trickle down to everybody else, isn't it? Again, that isn't. I think it's getting better in terms of people realizing the importance of it. I still don't see it actually becoming the real way that things work around here.
Exactly that. You just said something fantastic, actually. Hold each other accountable for it.
Yeah, yeah.
So leaders can talk the talk and they can look like they're walking the walk, but ultimately being held accountable for your own behavior as a leader and how that then is modeled through the organization is critical. And I don't think that's enough of, I guess, leadership being accountable to each other, calling each other out on things they may have done or maybe not have done, or their alignment to a particular value or why that value is driving something they do. So the holding accountable piece, I haven't seen a great deal of.
No, and it's interesting because I'm sure a lot of people talk to you about they want better performance in their business. We certainly, you know, talk to people who want that. But actually, when you say, when you dig deeper and say, well, what's accountability like in your business? How does it work? That's often where the first problem occurs, is that they want performance, yet they don't really do accountability very well. Well, how are you going to get performance if you don't hold people to account? You know, and that's not just behavior, that's, you know, for tasks, goals, whatever it might be. Yeah. That piece is often missing. That accountability focus is missing, and it's missing from the top down. not just in the middle down, but from the top down.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And interestingly, that stuff actually, that accountability doesn't seem to be connected. Well, the accountability might be connected to operational stuff, but culture seems to not be connected to operational stuff. It still seems to be seen as this nebulous thing that exists outside of operational reality, when actually it drives operational reality. So yeah, the values piece and the alignment piece and the accountability piece are critically important. It is getting better. People are more open to it now, to kind of see how these things happen and how you get performance by actually being a bit more holistic than cracking a whip and going, work harder, more heroics.
Yeah. So as you said, values must be lived. They mustn't just be stated somewhere on a slide pack or a website or wherever it might be. Yeah. You need to get this alignment across all levels of an organization. Yeah, not just middle down or even 100%. Just a coalface. And yeah. I guess the most important thing is, if you're in a leadership role, particularly a senior leadership role, is you have to create conditions for that truth that you're talking about to surface. And therein lies the problem, I think.
Yeah, essentially what we're talking about here is psychological safety. And that is a huge thing. And that's a huge assumption. In some organizations we've experienced it, where leaders will say, this is a safe space. You can give us feedback. We're open to it. But in those organizations, nobody's going to go and talk to the CEO about the things that they're experiencing day to day. That feedback doesn't really happen. So you have to, as a leader, you have to foster or engender a culture of that feedback without judgment. And you have to model it at the top. You absolutely have to model it at the top. Otherwise, your senior management team below you won't.
No, that's fair comment.
Yeah, and and the accountability piece stands. You know, if you're that leader, your senior management team aren't fostering that genuine, safe feedback loop, you have to hold them accountable. You can't just hand it off to them and go, well, I'm behaving in this way, you must behave the same way. It's kind of like, well, what is it you're doing to make sure that you're getting the feedback we need to improve performance?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we have got some clients at the moment we're doing work with where they are delving quite deeply at senior leadership level into holding each other much more to account on behavior, getting real, genuine, honest feedback from each other about how they see their behavior. And that's what you need. I mean, not enough businesses over the years I've seen that happening, but some of the ones we work with are definitely wanting to do that and are asking us to help them do that. And I think that's really, really encouraging. You just need to have it a lot wider, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I think the need, do you know what? I think the need for that kind of level of openness and coaching at all levels of a business is sorely missing in most businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Matt, well, we're into sort of three quarters of an hour of today's conversation. I think I'm going to call today's conversation there. We'll come back in part two, which we'll release next week, where I want to dive into your current work with the Culture Nav business that you work for, and how you actually start to create some of this decision intelligence that we're talking about. How do we really get under the skin of our businesses? But if you're leaving somebody with a thought for the next week as they wait for episode two to exist, what would be your sort of two or three things to say, take this away, have a think before you listen to part two?
I guess the biggest thing for me would be, culture is everybody's job. It's not just on leaders, and it's not just on HR, and it's not just on senior managers, it's on everybody. So from the person that just joined yesterday, right the way through, if you're having a moan about culture, oh, I don't like this because, oh, the culture's rubbish. But if you have a bit of a moan, unless you are taking the actions to improve that for yourself and others, then you're not in the game. So you need to think about how you're thinking, how you're contributing to that culture yourself. It's not any one person's job, it's everyone's. I think that's probably the biggest takeaway.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah. Okay, Matt, well, thanks for your time today. We'll have a break. We'll be back next week with part two. But for the time being, Matt, thanks for your time.
Great. Thanks so much, Dave.
If today's episode has struck a chord, please share it with someone that you might know that might need to hear it. Please give us a 5-star rating on your podcast channel, because this really helps us to get reach and inspire more leaders. Every week we send out a newsletter called Foresight, containing top tips from each episode. There's also a book recommendation, a thought to reflect on, and some practical takeaways that you can apply in your day-to-day life. Visit zentanogroup.com/podcast, add your name to our mailing list. But for today, thank you for listening.